Hey, everybody. We are back with a new episode of Working It Out. Today on the show, we have Michael J. Fox. He's just a legendary actor. I mean, between Family Ties on television, Back to the Future, countless films, television shows that are incredible. The Good Wife, The Good Fight. We talk about a lot of his acting stuff. He actually recently wrote a book that I love called No Time Like the Future. It's a memoir. It's so funny. He also wrote another book called Lucky Man, a memoir. I mean, he's just a fascinating writer, creator, actor. And we go into a lot of his nonprofit work with the Michael J. Fox Foundation. They've raised over $1 billion for Parkinson's research over the years. I've performed at a bunch of their benefits. I've done fundraising events. It's just a great, great group of people. We talk about this a little bit in the interview, but sleep disorders, like REM sleep behavior disorder, do have some correlation to Parkinson's. And so one thing they wanted to mention, the organization, is that if you wanted to volunteer for a study, if you have a sleep disorder, go to their site, which is michaeljfox.org. I should note that I just got finished with my run of shows at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. It was so much fun. It was really an extension of a lot of the work that happens on this podcast and making changes, and I continue to make changes and try different things. I next go to London and then Paris, Iceland. I go to the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor, New York, and Long Island, which is phenomenal. It's this gorgeous little 300-seat theater. And then I go to 40 performances in Los Angeles at the Mark Taper Forum. Incredible, incredible theater space. And I'm announcing some tour dates in the fall coming up soon that are, a lot of them are in the Midwest and the South, because I really want to get to as many cities with The Old Man in the Pool as possible. Michael J. Fox is one of the coolest guests we've ever had on our show. It's someone who I am completely in awe of. I think we have a great, great conversation today. This is a unique thing for this episode. We put a transcript of the episode on burbigs.com. So if you want to follow along with it, if there's anything you don't understand, there's a transcript of the interview. It's a great talk. I'm always in awe of and loved talking to the great Michael J. Fox. I want to recommend your recent book because it's funny and it's definitely a good thing for people who are struggling with adversity, because you actually, you know, you have a, you go there to the dark places, but then you come out the other side.
Yeah.
How do you think you get there? Because it's like, I feel like there, it's like how few people would be diagnosed with Parkinson's and their instinct would be, well, I'm going to try to cure Parkinson's. Like, to me, it would be like the ultimate excuse for why not to do anything.
Were that the case, I agree. It would have been nice. But it was an evolution of behavior and a thought and a reaction and attitude about it, which was, first I was diagnosed, and I kind of, the first thing I had to do was square with Tracy and find out we were okay and if she was okay. And she had no idea, of course, and she said she was okay, but it would have been forgiven if she 2 weeks later said, enough of this. But we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know, I mean, Parkinson's vaguely as a geriatric disease that some people had, like Muhammad had it, but that was considered to an extent pugilistic dementia. And it was all this stuff that I was trying to figure out. And in the meantime, I hid for 7 years. I have 7 years. I worked and I did my stuff, and I didn't tell anybody. The doctor told me that I had 10 years left to work. I was diagnosed.
Whew.
So, it was a big shot. 29 years old, and I had a lot of stuff going on, and so I really freaked out. And I just signed a big contract to do like a bunch of movies for a bunch of money, and just all irrational thinking, and crazy thinking, and so it's after a period of about 7 years, I went through all kinds of stuff. I went through I quit drinking, which was not an effective tool in dealing with Parkinson's. And then I had a great moment with Tracy where she evaluated my situation and very calmly, without anger, said, is this what you want? Is this what you want to do?
Yeah.
And it just shook me. And so I dealt with that, and I dealt with getting sober. And I started to understand the disease more. I started talking to more doctors, and I started to talk to, on the sly, more patients. And just really kept it close. And by the time I had released it to the public, I'd gone through these huge evolutions. I quit doing films out of the country and out of the city, and then started Spin City and picked my kids to school every day, with them at home every day, went to the movies at night. We had a regular life, and that was good. And then I started to see opportunities to do stuff. And I realized that I had to devote myself at that time totally to the foundations. So it wasn't just like, let's cure this, let's get this done. It was a long trip through the desert.
Yeah, yeah. And you, like, at a certain point, the foundation crossed like the $1 billion raised for Parkinson's research, Mark.
I say this with a great deal of pride and a great deal of affection and gratitude. Everyone involved, but $1 billion, 20 years, we haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
But I want to get it done. And so I'm very happy that we've raised $1 billion. We've had really great help from key donors and great help from Parkinson's patients. That was one of the cool things that we did. When we started out to be a research foundation and to be a foundation that really focused on that next big breakthrough. And that's happened. And we've broken some key initiatives and helped some drugs to market and done those things you'd expect us to do. But one of the things we become is a focal point for the energies of the Parkinson's community, of their families, of their children, of them themselves, whether it's as simple as finding out who's doing a bike-a-thon in your neighborhood, or perhaps more impacted than, in the long run, is getting involved in clinical trials.
Yeah.
And we have a list of clinical trials called Trial Finder. You can find something in your precinct that has opportunities to be of service. One of the big things we're into, and it's tricky because it's not a cure per se, but it's as close as you can get for those who are undiagnosed. Yeah. So there's a series of symptoms. Yours is one of them. Interrupted REM sleeping and messed up sleeping.
Yeah, I have REM sleep behavior disorder, which I've documented comedically in a lot of places.
You actually mentioned why you were passing by 3 a.m. the other day.
I should have said hi.
You were walking a raccoon and wearing a funny hat.
But do you find that, because I find this with my sleepwalking, is people think I'm an expert medically, and I have to be like, no, I don't know half the, you know, I don't know a tenth of the things these people know.
I would disagree with you in that, to the extent that patients, aside from all the Latin and the funny diagrams that you can't make sense of, we know more than our doctors, because we know what it's like to have the disease.
Oh, that's funny.
We know what it is. Like.
Yeah.
And I'm an expert on that. I'm an expert on what it's like to live with Parkinson's. And I don't want to forfeit that in any exchange I have with a doctor. I don't want everyone to yield that because it's really important. It's earned and it's powerful.
That's funny because, like, I think one of the things, I mean, in addition to the foundation, which is so impressive, it's like your acting is still great. You have this great line in your book where you go, as an actor, I can convincingly play anyone on earth as long as they have Parkinson's disease, which is like, that's a great comedy line.
This whole trip has been really weird. And like I said, I've had a really tough time the last few weeks beyond what was in the book.
No, I know. I heard that you had some trouble with your hand recently.
Yeah. You know, things like antibiotics and one size fits all kind of thing. When you go and take it to a hospital, God bless them all. They're great. And they work really hard. But for example, with Parkinson's, they don't know what Parkinson's meds do. So they don't know. They don't, mm-hmm. And they just have a patient that will not, that there's requested minimum. I don't drink. So I don't like narcotics. I don't like morphine. I don't like, I don't like any of that stuff. I don't want anything in my body. I want them to make me. Yeah. Succumb to their whims without being messed up for 3 months.
Yeah.
And so then what happens is they medicate you lightly and it's nice, but you start to move a little bit.
Yeah.
They have to hit that and hit that. And then you're kind of in another realm and you're not dealing with your initial issue, whatever it was, you're dealing with drugs or Parkinson's is hard for people to figure out.
Yeah.
And so they don't know how to deal with it. say they. There's a tendency to not know how to deal with that set of issues.
Yeah.
A hand injury, my doctor will say, be still. It's supposed to be still. That'd be great. You figure that one out. Give me a call. Ha, ha, ha.
You figure that one out. You let me know. I think one of the things that's remarkable, though, is like you're on Curb Your Enthusiasm. You're on, you know, Rescue Me and Good Wife with, you know, with some of the symptoms. And I think what's remarkable as an actor, I'm looking at you going like, well, you're still a better actor than me. And like, I got it all. I got all the faculties. I'm banging on all the cylinders. You got to deal with all this shit. It's like, what as an actor are you held back from? Is there anything that you're held back from doing that you couldn't do before?
Yeah. I have significant block with the last thing I did. I was cruising along doing the Good Wife and Larry's show and all this other stuff. I'm really loving it. And loving that idea that everybody has Parkinson's or that I can do anything as long as I have Parkinson's. Two thoughts are related. Because everybody has Parkinson's. Everybody has some shit.
You know, yes, everyone has something.
Something they do that they should not do. And so everybody's got this thing they're working on.
But I'm curious, like as an actor, like so much of it is observation and then observation, viewing, you know, seeing how people behave and then acting. And it's like,
well, that's the key thing. You can see past the Parkinson's, you can see past the other issues that they may have, and you see the central, it sounds so actory and
goofy. Yeah, yeah.
But to find the central truth, to find the essential truth of that character. And this guy's afraid. I do that and I look at that, and it's really a lot of fun. Like, I love playing this guy on Good Wife who was just evil. I mean, it's really hard to right with this guy. He played on people's emotions, played on their sympathies,
yeah,
and on their best intentions.
Yeah.
Just mutilated them with it. And then when I did, I guess, a spinoff from Good Wife, which was
Good Fight.
Good Fight. I couldn't remember the lines. And I just had this blank where I couldn't remember the lines.
Oh.
And it was strange because I was with family times, they used to give me the script. And I go, my man, Mallory, get off the phone. And then
wow,
I knew it like in an instant. And it continued to be the way for me. I have 70 pages of dialogue on a Palma movie, and knowing that a hugely expensive Steadicam shot, depending on me knowing those lines,
yeah, yeah,
a trickle of sweat off my brow. But it's just like that. And then I get to this point, I'm on a soundstage in Culver City. I can't get this line together. It was this legal stuff, and I just couldn't get it. But what was really refreshing was I didn't panic, I didn't freak out. I just went, what's that? Moving on. The key element of this process is remembering lines, and I can't do it. And I done a Kiefer show in Canada. I presume Last Man Standing. You'll get it. So I had the same problem. And so I was saying about that time, I'm a big Tarantino fan. And a big Brad Pitt fan and a big Leonardo DiCaprio fan. And I loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood because a lot of reasons. One was that when I moved out to Hollywood just after that.
Yeah.
And experienced a lot of that old Hollywood that doesn't exist anymore. That being said, was cool about it was he was doing a scene in a Western show and he couldn't remember his lines. He went back in the dressing room. He was screaming at himself. He was like, you know, he was just tearing into himself in the mirror and like, drinking and just a mess, and I thought about that. And I thought I don't want to feel that. So I don't. Am I wrong not to feel that? Am I right?
Yeah.
To feel that? Like, but here's what it tells me: I don't take on something with a lot of lines because I can't do it. I can't. And for whatever reason, I can't do the part of it. It just is what it is. I can't remember 5 pages of dialogue. I can't do it. Can't be done.
Yeah.
So I go to the beach.
So do you find, you know, it's like they say that, you know, my Aunt Lucy is blind and she has a better sense of hearing, and people are, you know, sometimes if they don't have their hearing, they have a better sense of sight. Do you feel like from Parkinson's you have a better sense of like observation or like anything like that?
Walking me right into this stuff. Beautiful.
Really?
Yeah, great. Well, because one of the things, I don't say this often anymore, and I used to say it all the time. I'm glad to have a chance to say it again. I couldn't be still until I couldn't be still.
Yeah.
I couldn't gauge what that center of my equilibrium was. That like there was a place I could get to that was came about, and my understanding of it came about because I had purposes. Because it was like saying, I like it with this thing. I don't have that choice anymore. I don't have this choice. I don't have that choice. I have other choices.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't be still and see those choices until I couldn't be still. It was other crap.
Yeah.
Like the peripatetic wanderings and weird flailings and body impulses that I feel as a Parkinson's patient, a sober Parkinson's patient, are nothing compared to what I felt as a drunken asshole. Like, I mean, that was a completely different thing. And that I couldn't be still, and I was less still.
Yeah.
Than I am now. As much as I'm moving around, I hear the ocean here, luckily, and the light's nice, and it's just talking to a friend, and it's all good. It's just take this now and enjoy it.
So I had this one thing on the checklist, which is when I was a kid, I wanted to be you as an actor, and as an adult, I want to be the kind of person who does the kind of things you do with your foundation. And so I wrote, you always try and deflect compliments. So, but I'm requesting that you say thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. and I just appreciate what you do. And first of all, you work as an artist. You truly are a unique informer on our times. And from your point of view, and what I try to do from my point of view, seems like a really small corner of the world. REM sleep disorder and sleepwalking. A big part of the world, and you're sharing about it, and your insights on it are huge, and they help me understand a lot of things about lack of control and acceptance and improvising and family, what family means, and so I love the work you're doing, and I love the chance to get to see you.
So this is this thing we do in the show called The Slow Round. It's based on sort of memories and things. Do you have a memory from your childhood where it just comes back to you sometimes and you don't even know why?
A lot of those. I think of random one. Being 4 years old and walking with my parents to the edge of a pond in our neighborhood, looking for frogs but finding turtles. And you're saying, looking for frogs but I found turtles.
Looking for frogs and finding turtles.
I found turtles. And then that turtles are really important to me. I have the turtle tattoo. The sea turtle, they didn't have those in the pond in Chilliwack, BC, but turtles remain important to me.
Why are they important to you?
Well, this turtle, I have this tattoo, which my wife just hates. And so I can't get another one. But I was, it was New Year's Eve, 1999 into 2000. And we were in the Caribbean, St. John's, and it was real. It was real swanky. There were a lot of cool people there. Alan, all his family, Mel Brooks, all these great people.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were going into this year, and we thought the world was going to end, and all the computers were going to crash. So I was looking for some kind of clarity, and I was trying to figure out what to leave the show and start the foundation. And so I went swimming. It was twilight. And we'd have a quick swim and go get ready for the evening. The kids were getting ready. And I said, I'm going to go for one last snorkel. So I go in the water, just up on the beach. And very shortly into my snorkel, this turtle comes out of the reeds. He's like this big, massive turtle. And he's missing a chunk out of his fin, and he's got a big scar on his. And I said, this mother has been through it. This guy's been through it.
Yeah.
Like, go back to the little trundle down the beach, like probably 30 years ago, where everyone's getting picked up by ospreys and badgers and stuff. And this guy made it. And there he was in my area, my zone where I'm. So I looked at him, swam after him for a while. And I just got to, this guy was going to do the next right thing.
Yeah. Like,
his only agenda, do the next right thing.
Yeah.
And I got in the water and I said to Tracy, I said, I'm leaving the show. I'm going to do the foundation.
Wow.
It seems very like self-generated, lore, but it's truly what happened.
Yeah. What's the best piece of advice that anyone's ever given you that you did that worked?
My father said to me when I wanted to be an actor, I moved to the States, and he had no comprehension. He thought I was a hippie, but I was working, and he was a military guy, and I was working, and he couldn't argue with that. Like dollars and cents, where I was like, as a 17-year-old, I was making maybe that $16,000 a year, like a good set of money. So that drove the course of all my work. And so when I said I wanted to move to Hollywood, he said, "Well, if you're going to be a lumberjack, you might as well go to the goddamn forest." That was it. I got it. And other people like Jeffrey Katzenberger said to me, "When in the bull ring, don't wear red."
Oh, yeah.
And that's what else. It's just about like a lot of program stuff, a lot of, I get into it specifically, but a lot of stuff with the program that helped me quit drinking and get sober. It's about acceptance.
Yeah.
About understanding and about just like, if you accept something, doesn't mean you resign to it.
Yeah.
You're going to endeavor to change it. But if you accept the truth of it first,
yeah,
this is the truth of my situation.
Yeah.
Under those terms. But if I look at it from another angle, it gives me opportunities and it gives me all kinds of chances to do things.
Yeah, I think that's phenomenal advice. I think that's one of the very strange things about this moment in history, in a broad sense, is that the what is true is so heavily debated that none of us can get to acceptance on kind of the worldview of the whole thing.
It's terrible. I mean, right now, you can run into a door and like everything is, you said, there's no accepted truth. There's no good faith attempt at a co-understanding. There's no, people won't exploit that. And both sides, although, we always say that there's unfair characterization of two different situations, that this is this, and this is real, but the other side sees it the same way. So, and even thinking the other side, like those terms, it's also screwy. Everything's polarized, and everyone's forced to take a position on a truth that is not filtered through their own process of right and wrong, but it's filtered through some other gas bag in Midtown Manhattan, coming up with this crap. It's hard.
Yeah. What do you remember being an inauthentic version of yourself from any part of your life that you cringe at?
Oh yeah. Well, I used to have to like run a reel. Being like David Letterman, who I love, I think it was 41, 42 times over the boy and man, the NBC, CBS spectrum. I'm going on the show with big glasses and cowboy boots and. What are you, Dr. Roof?
Oh my gosh, was that in your 20s or 30s?
My 20s. I was at any given moment anybody.
Oh my gosh.
I came from Canada in 1979. I worked for a couple of years and did like Here's Boomer and Lou Grant. I mean, it kind of like weird trading thing. And then I had to sit. I was still literally down to it. Do you play poker?
A little bit, yeah.
I was down to chipping a chair. I was down to like, and that had all kinds of implications. If I left, I owed the IRS like $10,000, so I wouldn't be able to come back and earn that money back.
Oh, my God.
I knew going back meant my brother, who's a great guy, had a lot of construction sites. He was superintendent of that. I would have been picking up nails on the construction sites. It just all was bad. It was down to the last second, and I got family ties, and my life changed.
Oh, wow.
And like that's just, always have that thing to look to and say, shit can happen. Like you can't set the bar high enough.
Yeah.
To eliminate the possibility of good things happening. And so that's the thing, like people say, it's all pointed to crap. How can you be optimistic? It's all terrible. It's like, how about you? But I'm hanging off that last minute when it's great. I'm pulling that.
Yeah. Growing up, do you have a memory of like a really strange neighbor or a really unique neighbor?
Yeah, I had a few. We had a woman that we lived in at one point, when my father said in the military, we lived in a three-story walk-up middle gate apartments, and it had a swimming pool, but that was fed it in. awful. And I think it eventually shut down. But the manager of this place was a woman. She was insane. She had dark, like she was a country star. Anyway, she had dark, flowing raven hair, and she wore like white cowboy boots and I don't think they had Spanx then, but Spanx like.
Yeah, Spanx-esque
material. And she was very brusque and very, and it was always an opportunity to warn us children that we would be the cause of the eviction of our parents.
Yeah.
And I said, why are you going to go hit with a 9-year-old about behaving like this? I had a pet mouse that I bought with science class, and then he got out. So then I was the scourge of the neighborhood because I let this mouse out in the neighborhood, and she was just, the way she said, I found that mouse. I live in fear of this woman coming, popping out of the hall, demanding that I find this mouse. Like, he's a white mouse. He's not like he's going to float in and be like a sign of a pestilence in the building. He's clearly from the bed sort of stream. But that's a weird neighbor.
So, like, when you watch a movie, read a book, you know, see a play, like, what's the thing that you crave? Like, what's the thing that's your, like, favorite thing?
Honest human connection. Like, I was watching a movie last night. It was really cool. And I don't often like films like this. It's called Rain of Fire. It was about these dragons that populate Europe. And Christian Bale plays this guy who was one of the first ones as a kid to find the dragon. And his mother was killed by the dragons. But it was Christian Bale, Matthew McConaughey, and Gerard Butler. And we're all in this movie. And we're all great.
Yeah.
But look at that, and I say, they're all great. Christian Bale can act his ass off.
Yeah.
You know, he just, that's another level.
Oh, that's a whole thing.
McConaughey is great, and he's getting in this role. He's all buff, and his eyes are glinty, and he says stuff with a cigar in his teeth. And that's all great. But Christian Bale, just in this goofy movie, where he's making you cry. He's so good.
Yeah. Do you have a smell from your childhood that you remember?
Yeah, I don't have smell now, which is functional Parkinson's disease, which is another one of those things on the list.
No kidding, jeez.
But I remember the smell of pine. Just after Christmas, this apartment building I lived in had balconies, fire escapes, and everyone would put their trees out there for New Year's and before they picked up, they just couldn't put them on the road. And the whole place smelled like pine. It smelled like a pine forest.
Wow. So what's a thing that you've always enjoyed in your life that you're still enjoying that's like, in solitude?
I love to meditate at the beach. I was just doing it this morning. This is sitting on the beach. The pound of the waves set the rhythm. You just go. And they come back 25 minutes later and say, well, nothing's changed, but everything's changed.
I wrote this joke recently when I was in Minnesota, but it makes me think of Canada, which is, I find that people who live in these cold climates, they're so tough. You know, it's like they have calluses for the weather at a certain point. So I was making small talk with the taxi driver from the airport. I go, how's it going with the weather? You know, because it's 0 degrees. And the taxi driver just goes, I can't take it anymore. And I thought, can you take it for another 10 minutes? Because we're pretty close to the hotel. When you were growing up in Canada, did you ever clock how goddamn cold it is?
Yeah,
there?
Sometimes it got really cold. When I think of cold is going on camping trips. Like, we go on camping trips in November. And it's like for school.
Yeah.
It's so cold. I don't believe children didn't die. And we would have carried on anyway, but it's so cold that you're freezing from the inside out.
Yeah.
Like, normally the inside of you is the last vestige of warmth. It's like started somewhere in your perineum and just radiated fingers of ice through your whole body.
Yeah. I think there's correlation between comedy and weather, because the amount of comedians and comedic actors out of Canada, Minnesota, Massachusetts, I mean, it's completely disproportionate. Well,
there's a lot of truisms about the business, by the way. Time plus tragedy equals comedy.
Yeah.
And the other is heat is the enemy of comedy.
I've never heard that. Heat is the enemy of comedy.
I guarantee you go to the set of some sitcom that had an audience, they got that thing cranked down to like 62. Because if you're alive, if you're alive, you're going to be involved in whatever shiny thing they put in front of you, and that's our show.
Yeah. And then I jotted this thing down recently, which is, this is just a true story. My whole career, I've heard about these professional airport greeters who escort celebrities through the airport. And I always thought, that's not for me. You know, it's not who I am. And then during the pandemic, I was like, all right, I'm going to do the airport greeter thing. So I meet this woman on the curb, JFK. She walks me through security. And we're walking through totally. This is word for word. She goes, one time I told Hugh Jackman that there's a little nook behind a restaurant in right there in Terminal 2, and it's private, it's got great food, and I brought him there, and he loved it. And I go, is that where we're going? And she said, nope. And then we went to the food court. And then it was never discussed again.
That little nook, where's that little nook? Did only Hugh Jackman knows.
Yeah. And then we went to the food court, and she tried to use her card for a 15% discount, and the cashier said, is it for you or is it for him? And I'm holding pizza that's clearly for me, and I go, oh, it's for me. And then we didn't get the 15% discount, and that's when I realized I am not Wolverine. I'm like an Arctic fox eating a pizza at full price.
You can't buy that again. They kind of wait, they can get you the pizza at a discount.
Yes. What is the, because you, I mean, genuinely, I grew up on your movies, and to me, I look at you and go like, well, you clearly like have it all. You could do anything. What is the luxury that actually is as good as someone would think it is?
I can say yes first to my family. I can say yes without thinking about it. We want to go here. Yes.
Oh, that's what you're saying.
I like have this for dinner. Yes. Yes is the first answer because they've never done anything to dishonor that. And man.
Yeah.
Well, but it's a great thing. Like I can't even, like, can we go to Disneyland? We've been to Disneyland 14 times, never in a line.
Yeah. What's the inverse? What's the thing that doesn't matter how rich and famous you are, it's just, you got to deal with it.
Well, I mean, that's every day. That's with this and look and say, I can't. And then the other side, I can't go there. I can't go to the store right now. I can't go to the restaurant right now.
Okay, so the final thing we do on the show is it plays right into what we're already talking about, which is working it out for a cause. And if there's one thing that you want people to know about the Fox Foundation, what is that single thing and how can they help?
Is it... I said, paraphrase Barack Obama, but different way. You are the agent of change that you're looking for.
Yeah.
You are the tool that'll get this done. And you can get involved with trials, you can get involved with anecdotal information that goes into several pipelines that then make that information accessible. Again, accessible to researchers and other patients. Like, we can sit around and talk about it. We can do something about it.
Yeah.
And doing something about it, maybe sitting around and talking about it, but it's attached to an action.
Yeah.
We don't have an endowment. We don't have a big pile of money that we didn't dole out to people. Money comes in and goes out. We've identified the science before we've earned the money. And the science is ahead of the money still. And so we gotta reach that. And we get placed where the money is ahead of the science. We've done it.
Michael, I can't thank you enough for doing this. This has been so enlightening. And I feel so lucky to have met you. You're one of my heroes in my life and to witness close up, so, you know, what you're able to do sort of on and off screen is unbelievable.
I see some of your time as you say, you, first of all, are a genius. Like, the work you do, the things you find, the truths you seek out and find, and the observations you make always touch me. Thank you. Thank you for getting involved in our foundation. Thank you for all your talents, to our efforts, and love to your family. And carry on. Thanks.
Working it out, because it's not done. We're working it out, because there's no one.
That's going to do it for another episode of Working It Out. That is Michael J. Fox. You can support the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research at michaeljfox.org. You can follow him on Instagram at @realmikejfox. I follow him on Instagram. I'm at @Berbigs. Our producers of Working It Out are myself, along with Peter Salamone and Joseph Berbiglia, consulting producer Seth Barish, sound mix by Kate Belinsky, associate producer Mabel Lewis. Special thanks to my consigliere Mike Berkowitz, as well as Marissa Hurwitz and Josh Upfall. Special thanks to Jack Antonoff and Bleachers for their music. They are on tour. When they're in London, I'm going to be in London. I'm going to get to see them again. I saw them in Texas. They are on fire. Bleachers. As always, very special thanks to my wife, the poet J. Hope Stein. Our book is called The New One. It's a mixture of poetry and comedy. It is at your local bookstore. Support your local bookstores. And Jen's book, which is called Little Astronaut, is a collection of poetry. You can pre-order today. It comes out in September. It is a beautiful book. As always, a special thanks to our daughter, Una, who created a radio fort made of pillows. And thanks most of all to you who are listening. Tell your friends. Go on to Apple Podcasts and say which was your favorite episode of the show. And so if people come on, they see the 75 episodes and they don't know where to begin, they can look at your recommendation and go, oh, wow, this person is directing me to their favorite episode. Thank you all for telling your friends, for telling your enemies. We're working it out. We'll see you next time, everybody.